Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, college students are preparing for an uncertain year. We'll talk to some about how they're approaching higher education during a pandemic. Local schools are also getting ready for students. Many will start off taking classes remotely. We'll look at how that might be different now compared to the spring. Illinois' longest-serving governor, Jim Thompson, passed away last week. We'll hear from a Statehouse reporter who covered all of Thompson's tenure.
He was able to negotiate with the Democrats because he didn't have these hard set opinions that's got to be my way or the highway, and some of the things that he believed in, the Democrats believed in too.
Looking back at Big Jim Thompson, and a Central Illinois man impacted by tragedy half a world away. His story and more coming up this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead this hour, we'll hear from some college students as they get ready for what is sure to be a different kind of year. Many students in kindergarten through high school will start their year remote learning. What might be different from the spring? We'll take a closer look. And local governments have a challenge collecting taxes during a pandemic. Those stories and more this hour on Statewide. In the past week, there was news that the longest-serving governor in the state's history had died. Dave McKinney takes a look at the legacy of James R. Thompson.
In 1981, the 6'6" Illinois Republican known as Big Jim was gearing up for his third run as governor, and President Ronald Reagan was in Chicago to help him raise money. Reagan praised Thompson for his time as a corruption-busting U.S. attorney prior to becoming governor. That's when he became best known for convicting a former governor and one of Chicago's most powerful aldermen on corruption charges.
Tonight we're here to honor a big man in Illinois. Now there's no doubt that Jim Thompson's tall, but Jim built his fame and a different kind of size as a courageous prosecutor, fighting corruption in places people said could never be rid of it.
Thompson was born in DeKalb. He got a law degree at Northwestern and eventually landed in the federal prosecutor's office in Chicago. With no electoral experience, Thompson won the governorship in 1976, a post he held until 1991. Thompson was a moderate Republican in charge of a state with a Democratic-led legislature for much of his four terms. And in this 2016 retrospective by the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum, Thompson recalled specializing in splashy building projects, many of which still stand today.
No question about it, I was a builder. It's part of my makeup. I believed that the projects I supported and saw brought to completion were important for the state of Illinois.
He helped build a new stadium for the Chicago White Sox. He transformed Navy Pier from a dilapidated eyesore into Illinois' largest tourist draw. He hired a world-renowned architect to draw up designs for the Loop office building that bears his name. In 2012, in an Elmhurst College speech recorded by the Illinois Channel, Democratic House Speaker Michael Madigan reflected on Thompson's unique leadership skills.
Governor Thompson is a very intelligent person, understood that he was involved in government, where everybody's entitled to their due, and that you need to fashion compromise if you wish to move forward.
Indeed, to Thompson, compromise wasn't a bad word.
I had a pet phrase I used from time to time. You can always compromise your ideas, but you can't compromise your ideals. And while that sounds like a pat statement, it really reflects the nature of the political and legislative process.
Thompson also connected with average Illinoisans. He regularly opened the Illinois State Fair with a 40-foot plunge down a big yellow slide, once even carrying a dog along on his lap. He also helped launch the political careers of his two Republican successors, Jim Edgar and George Ryan. Here's Edgar.
That was a hard act to follow.
Edgar told WBEZ that Thompson was larger than life, a leader capable of charming enemies. Still, Edgar said he felt a need to establish his own political identity separate of Thompson, with whom he shared the same first name and even middle initial.
So I don't know if you ever noticed, but when I became Secretary of State and Governor, all the official documents, everything. I was Jim Edgar. I never was James R. Edgar. And part of that was I was trying to get away from, you know, I had to get out from under his shadow a little bit.
When Thompson left office, he became chairman and CEO of Winston & Strawn. That Chicago law firm defended Ryan, Thompson's friend and two-time running mate, against federal corruption charges. On Saturday, Pritzker called Thompson, quote, one of the titans in the history of state government. Addressing his own legacy, Thompson said in 2016 that his time in office made Illinois a better place, even if polling near the end of his record-setting tenure showed that his popularity had begun to fade somewhat.
If you're elected four times in a state as diverse as Illinois, to me that's the ultimate poll.
Thompson died of heart failure at the Shirley Ryan Ability Lab in Chicago. He was 84. This is Dave McKinney.
Emeritus Professor Charlie Wheeler spent decades as a State House reporter. He covered all of Thompson's time in office, and I had a chance to speak with him about the former governor. When you think of Jim Thompson and his time in office, what stands out to you?
Probably that he was maybe the most effective campaigner that I've ever seen. And secondly, particularly in this day and age, he was a Republican who was very comfortable working with Democrats, very comfortable working out compromises for the good of the state. As a matter of fact, as governor, he only had a two-year period in which one chamber of the General Assembly was controlled by Republicans. The rest of the time, it was 14 years in office. All of his years, there was Democratic control of the Senate, and 12 out of the 14, Democrats controlled the House. And so he was someone who was able to work with the other side quite well. And part of it was that he wasn't a rigid ideologue. I mean, you look at our last Republican governor, and he put out demands that anyone who was a student of Illinois politics would know were unreasonable, particularly trying to neuter public employee unions. Thompson, on the other hand, Thompson signed the legislation that authorized collective bargaining for teachers and for state workers. There was an issue during the period when Republicans controlled the House and George Ryan was Speaker. The House committee that handled business and labor issues, the conservative Republican majority on the committee put out from the committee to the floor a bill that would have provided right to work in the state of Illinois. And of course, the unions were totally apoplectic about it. There was this huge rally on the state house lawn. Thompson came out and spoke to the guys, to the union guys, and wound up inviting them over to the mansion for a kegger. He was a very, very pragmatic politician. And as I say, he was a charismatic campaigner. And one of his PR people back then, or I guess it was one of his pollsters, said he was one of the few candidates he's seen where people are enthusiastic and say, yes, I really want to vote for this guy.
Talk about the fact that he did not serve in the General Assembly before becoming governor. Sometimes that's been a detriment to governors. They often have not been able to work well with the legislature, not having that experience. That was not the case, though, with Jim Thompson, as you mentioned.
No, and I think part of it was the attitude that he came in with. Some of the people that some of the older hands that he asked for assistance, asked for help. He had just an incredible budget director in Bob Mandeville to work with all the financial stuff. He was able to negotiate with the Democrats because he was not, he didn't have these hard set opinions that's got to be my way or the highway. And some of the things that he believed in, the Democrats believed in too. For example, public works. He put through what at the time was a huge public works program called Build Illinois. And if I'm not mistaken, there are some residual parts of it still going on. There's a Build Illinois fund that I believe gets a cut of sales tax every year, and it's still used to pay for projects. And this goes back to early in Thompson's tenure.
You mentioned the budget, and that's something where he has been criticized. Look back, and the budget basically doubled under his tenure. Now, he was in office for 14 years, so you know, budget growth is expected. I heard him in an interview say, while that was not something he was necessarily proud of, he was proud of being able to expand programs he felt helped people and that certain agencies needed that boost of revenue. Your thoughts on that? You covered the budget during his tenure. What kind of mark would you give him?
I would say that under the circumstances, it did okay. They were dealing with bad economic times when they first came in. Thompson and his administration managed to get a temporary income tax in 1983 after a lot of back and forth, and it was a bipartisan effort. Then later on, it was in his final term when we had another bad economic state and we were running out of money, and he had asked for an income tax increase, and Madigan wasn't willing to go along. And finally, I want to say this would have been 89, probably around April or May, Madigan announced and passed through the House in a matter of hours an income tax increase. And his explanation was along the lines of, well, the governor's wanted this for a long time, and I thought it over, and I finally realized, yeah, this is probably a good thing.
He was considered a moderate. Your thoughts on his politics and how he was able to work with Democrats and also his own party?
Yeah, he definitely was a moderate, particularly in terms of today's Republicans. I'm guessing that were Jim Thompson to arrive on the scene today as fresh out of the U.S. Attorney's Office and with no political background to speak of, he would more likely be a Democrat than he would be a Republican. And if he wanted to be a Republican, a lot of people in the party would look at him and call him a rhino. But they would say that about Jim Edgar. They'd say that about Charles Percy, too. He was conservative on law and order issues. One of the things that he managed to get through early on was a program called Class X Felonies. Up until that time, the sentence that an individual would get when he was convicted involved a lot of judicial discretion. Under Class X, certain offenses were made mandatory prison times, no probation for more serious offenses, and judicial discretion in other areas was severely limited. And so one of the results was this humongous building program for new prisons. I would say, without having to worry about being corrected, that Jim Thompson probably built more prisons in Illinois than anybody else since or before.
When you look at his legacy, did he leave a legacy in state government?
Yeah, I think he did. The building program was one thing. The fact that he created a couple agencies, if I recall correctly, I think alcoholism and substance abuse was one that he had set up, although that later got it folded into big human service agency. In my mind, he kind of set the example for someone who was from Chicago, wanted to run statewide, and took the trouble to go around the state trying to understand people from other areas. And he was a real showman, too, because I covered him on a couple of his early campaigns. This was back in the days when the Chicago papers and the St. Louis paper would put somebody on a candidate for governorship or for U.S. Senate for the last couple of weeks, and you just follow them around day in and day out. The baptism by fire for new reporters when they were starting out, we'd go to East Peoria, and at that time there was this huge caterpillar plant there, and I don't know if it's still there or if it has as many workers, but the shift would change at 6 o'clock in the morning, and the workers would come out, and politicians would stand there and shake their hands, and then they'd go across the street to a bar called Jugs Anthony, and Thompson would go in there. The challenge for a new reporter is, oh, come on, you got to have what everybody else is having. What's that, a shot and a beer? And so you get the shot, and it was some Lebanese liqueur, home-brewed, and it was potent as all get out. And if you could get it down, then you were okay. If not, you get laughed at if you choked or sputtered. But he did stuff like that. Another occasion I remember, he was campaigning on the south side, And I forget what the event he was at, but he we're going up Halsted Street, and there is the 11th Ward Democratic headquarters, the home base of Richard J. Daley, Richard M. Daley, the whole machine right there in their ward headquarters. So the cars stop. Thompson gets out, walks in, says hello to the guys, and the look on their face was just amazing. It would be, I kind of imagine what the look would be if the Pope showed up in Hades. But and Thompson was enjoying every minute of it, and the ward guys didn't know what to do. But he was that kind of guy. Once upon a time, when he was running against Mike Bacallus, he rode a horse around the rotunda, and Bacallus criticized him. Well, that's governor shouldn't do that. And Thompson said, well, they asked me to ride the horse, so. But he had this ability to really relate to people. I think that helped him. His congenial personality helped him in being able to deal with people like Michael Madigan or people, you know, with the Daily people in Chicago. Thompson was able to work very well with people from across the aisle because he was not rigid, and he understood the notion that if you can find common ground with the other side, if you can get what kind of some of the things you're looking for, if they can get kind of some of the things they're looking for, it's better for everybody. I don't know if this is true of Pritzker or not, because I'm not in a position to find out. I doubt that it was true with Rauner. I would bet any amount of money was not true with Blagojevich. But anyway, Thompson was very affable with the press corps. You could call him up of an evening. You could call the mansion. The trooper would answer and say, who is this? And I listened to Bob Hillman do this, who was my bureau chief at the time, because he covered the governor. I covered the legislature. And he'd say, hey, this is Bob Hillman. Can I speak to the governor? And it'd be a pause for a minute, and then it'd be, you could hear the governor would say, yeah, what do you want? And they'd carry on. And he'd take reporters' phone calls like that. Or he'd walk through the press room, the old press room, come in the bureau, sit down, have a beer. He was that kind of an individual, very accessible for the press.
Charlie Wheeler is an emeritus professor who previously covered state government for the Chicago Sun-Times during all of Jim Thompson's 14 years in office. You're listening to Statewide. Just ahead, a COVID-19 test that's being called a game changer. It was developed and is in use right here in Illinois. That story is next. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, for some, the college experience is getting ready to begin, but what will it be like in this anything but ordinary year? That story's on the way. A saliva-based COVID-19 test created by University of Illinois researchers received emergency authorization from the FDA this week. As students get ready to return, labs on the Urbana campus are now running upwards of 10,000 tests a day. Governor J.B. Pritzker says he wants to see the test used on campuses across the state. Christine Herman, Illinois Newsroom's health reporter, spoke with the U of I chemist Paul Hergenrother about what's next.
Can you talk about what the dynamics are when it comes to other campuses implementing the saliva-based test that was developed here?
We're hopeful that our entire process from beginning to end can be a great model for schools in the state and beyond. It starts up front with the collection sites. We have 40 collection stations on campus. You've seen the big conspicuous white tents, and that process is running very, very smoothly. The real key to all of this is having an on-campus CLIA lab, right? A certified lab that can do diagnostic testing. We were fortunate to have Tim Fan really work hard to convert the vet diagnostic lab that is really a world-leading veterinary lab. Portion of that now has been carved out for COVID testing. And so that is what allows results to get back to patients rapidly. So, you know, there's a tight coordination at the tents every hour. Samples are driven down to the diagnostic lab for rapid processing.
You know, obviously there's a lot of interest in lots of places about getting more rapid testing that's also affordable, that avoids supply chain bottlenecks like the saliva-based test that you've developed does. Even the Unit 4 superintendent has expressed interest in using the saliva test to be able to safely reopen schools. How might an arrangement with local K-12 school districts work?
Yeah, we would love to be able to help them. And There's a Shield, Illinois that is being built, basically where this type of lab is being replicated at various locations throughout the state. We just, one, needs more capacity. I mean, we have our hands full with just testing everybody here. There's, I don't know that there's any other place in the country that's kind of at 10,000 a day, right? Like we're doing. But once that lab is duplicated locally, then that will be capacity that can go to the community.
And I wanted to also just get your reaction to the news this week that University of North Carolina was shifted to all virtual after they identified more than 100 cases among hundreds of students that were tested in the first week back. Is that the sort of thing you ever worry could happen at the University of Illinois with reopening and the semester starting next week?
Well, that's exactly why we're doing this, right? I mean, you know, all of our modeling from our kind of expert modelers and then also nationally has been that frequent repeat testing is the way out of this, right? And so if you test twice a week, the idea is that you can identify infections. Of course, there's going to be infections. You identify them rapidly, you isolate them before they have a chance to spread. And the only way the campus, our campus was going to open was if we had this testing in place. So that's exactly why we're doing it. That's why, you know, we initiated this kind of Manhattan Project style effort that I led in May to kind of develop the test, right? Because there wasn't a suitable test out there that we could use that didn't have supply chain bottlenecks that would allow it to be used on 10,000 a day. And so then the implementation phase of this began in July. And so we've been running full steam for 3 months or so because of that exact fear.
At U of I chemistry professor Paul Hergenrother speaking with Illinois Newsroom's Christine Herman. Going to college for the first time can be scary and stressful. Try doing it during a pandemic. Kate McGee spoke to freshmen across the University of Illinois system on how they're feeling just before classes begin.
When Elizabeth LeBeau decided to attend the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign last December, she didn't realize how relieved she'd feel to be just a few hours from her home in suburban Lombard.
I was thinking how December me was actually very smart of staying in state.
On Wednesday, she'll move into a dorm on campus with her roommate, whom she met on Facebook. She felt she'd focus more on school if she wasn't at home. She and her roommate established some ground rules. No parties this semester. Masks are a must. And LeBeau decided to put off joining a sorority.
Sorority houses are going to be super spreaders because one person's going to go to a bar and then everyone has it type thing.
LeBeau is less worried about getting sick and more worried students won't take the virus seriously and ruin the semester for everyone.
Being sent home and not getting a refund on my housing or having to like put all this work into moving into college and then having people being like, actually, no, you're going home. And like the disappointment of that, having to be like, oh, another thing's taken away from me.
Many college freshmen say they're feeling nervous, uncertain, and confused. Other students just don't plan to show up. A survey released last week by the higher education research group Simpson Scarborough found 40% of incoming freshmen surveyed say it's unlikely they'll attend a four-year college this fall as planned. For those who still plan to enroll, like University of Illinois freshman Aiden Rogers, many say it doesn't feel real.
It's kind of weird. Like when I think about it, I'm like, oh, I'm really going to college. And then it's like, oh, but am I kind of going to college? It's just going to be me sitting in a dorm room most of the time.
The majority of students in the U of I system are taking their classes online. That's one reason Julia Kozniowski decided to live at home in the suburb Hoffman Estates while taking classes at the University of Illinois at Chicago. She'll also save money. She's curious how she's going to make friends or find study partners from a Zoom class.
Are these people actually going to help me? Are they going to know how to do the work? Are these the right people that I should be working with?
Students are also struggling to keep track of constantly changing safety requirements. Universities share updates via email or on a website, but students say it's obvious from social media that some aren't checking regularly. Others might not know how to access their emails yet. Roger says some students at U of I took matters into their own hands on the app GroupMe.
It's a bunch of our freshmen made a GroupMe called I'm Confused UIUC. And we always talk about like, hey, what's going on? What's this? Do I have to do this? That sort of thing. So that's been really helpful.
Jacynth Valera also decided to move on campus at UIC, even though all her courses are online. She's sharing a six-bedroom apartment with three other freshmen.
We're all living on one side, and then on the other side, we're specifically making it so that if one of us feels like we're getting sick or one of us was out all night, then we would just quarantine ourselves for a little bit over on the other side.
Valera says she's also sad because she thought freshman year would be a time to try new things.
Maybe my next years of college are going to be harder, so I'm not going to have that much time then, so I would enjoy my time now. And I feel like it's going to be the opposite of that.
But Elizabeth LeBeau at UIUC says she's getting used to things being different than they were before.
My generation, especially my class, we were born after 9/11, and we've always been told, like, oh, before 9/11, everything was so nice. You didn't have to go through, like, all this security at the airport. We kind of just all lived in, like, the 90s. So I feel like I've kind of been used to it because it's been happening my entire life. So what's freshman year of college or senior year of high school, you know?
Still, she's hoping to make the most of whatever on-campus experience she can get this fall.
Kate McGee with that report. Well, the school year will start remotely for many Illinois students. That's after pushback from parents and teachers. Peter Medlin reports on how online learning went for students in the spring and how it could be a different experience now.
As the pandemic began to surge, schools closed and most students switched to online learning almost overnight. Schools with less access to technology relied on paper packets, especially for younger elementary students. It was more like crisis teaching. Like building a plane as you're flying it. That's what Lindsay Zelli says. She's the director of professional learning at the Illinois Digital Educators Alliance.
They didn't really have time to figure out all the little nuances that come with lesson planning remotely and meeting the needs of learners in an online setting, or perhaps even reaching learners who don't have access to internet.
Rockford Superintendent Aaron Jarrett said in May that 1,200 of their families didn't have adequate internet service. The Dixon Community School District solicited a parent survey asking about the biggest challenge their kids face learning from home. And through a Freedom of Information Act request, WNIJ obtained hundreds of those responses. Spotty internet frustrated families. Parents wrote about their kids juggling a single device for their schoolwork. Educators were often praised for helping them get through assignments, while numerous parents cited a lack of teacher interaction as a major issue. Childcare was one of their biggest concerns. The United States is seeing a childcare crisis during COVID-19, and it's no different for Northern Illinois parents. A parent of an elementary school student wrote that, quote, my child gets passed around to five people and houses for childcare depending on who's available to watch them. A Dixon Middle School family said, quote, my husband and I are both essential workers. We were having to stay up late to help with homework. It was very, very hard on our son as well as the parents. And that problem hasn't been solved for schools starting out online this fall. Childcare is expensive and could put low-income families in a bind. Districts like DeKalb are trying to offer options. Interim Superintendent Griff Powell says they're partnering with several childcare organizations, including the YMCA, who can also help students with remote learning.
We have reached out and we are actually housing some of those activities in a couple of our buildings.
Online learning in the fall will look considerably different than the last spring. For one, it'll be longer. The Illinois State Board of Education is mandating 5 hours of remote learning. 2.5 of it must be synchronized with the class working at the same time. Some school districts prioritized professional development for their teachers to feel better implementing a remote learning curriculum. In a district survey, 64% of Freeport teachers said they needed more of that help. And a third of those same teachers said they see themselves as beginners, who know the basics but not much more, or just slightly above that, when it comes to teaching new material online. Lindsay Zelli says the Illinois Digital Educators Alliance held online sessions throughout the spring and summer.
A big point that I try and make to teachers is to do less. It's hard to connect with learners, so pick the thing that you're passionate about and teach that first, because that passion is going to reach students beyond the screen much better than, you know, unit one.
They've also held presentations for parents looking to help their kids with remote learning. The other key difference between the spring and the fall? Grading. In April, Illinois decided grades wouldn't count for or against students, which made it difficult for some to stay motivated, and engagement often nosedived as the virtual year came to a close. By the end, participation at some Rockford elementary schools fell below 20%, but numbers at other schools hovered in the 80s and even 90s. Only 25% of DeKalb students were present and logged in for all 29 e-learning days. The typical letter grading system will be back this fall, much closer to a regular school year. Griff Powell says that's just one of the reasons he thinks participation is going to be much better. The other reason is that now a lot of those teachers do feel more comfortable teaching online. Educators are experimenting with things like Bitmoji classrooms. It's a cartoon digital hub where students can click to explore resources. Think of a bookshelf that links to the library. Lindsay Zelli says it's impossible to recreate the classroom experience online, but they can still bring a little normalcy to a year that's been the farthest thing from normal. I'm Peter Medlin.
COVID-19 idled meatpacking and ethanol facilities nationwide, but as Harvest Public Media's Christina Stella reports, some think this year's disruptions could impact farm incomes all the way into 2021.
Before any talk of the coronavirus, many farmers were already struggling. Now, farmers are expected to receive billions in federal aid. Nathan Kaufman at the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank says these payments will prevent the worst. What they don't do is raise prices that have been low for years, or prevent a second drop in demand for beef.
Some of those stresses appear to be less than what they would have been in April, but still leaving a lot of concern about what that might look like, say, going into next year.
As the economy continues struggling, Kaufman says more budget-conscious shoppers could turn away from beef. The USDA predicts the retail cost of beef will rise 8% in 2020. But so far, ranchers are enjoying higher cattle prices while they can. Christina Stella, Harvest Public Media.
You're listening to Statewide. Local governments are trying to balance how to collect taxes during COVID-19 while also taking into account what can be paid. Chase Kavanaugh has more on that story.
For an Illinois county, property taxes are a major source of revenue. They're also one that county government has the authority to directly collect. Ogle County Treasurer Linda Beck says the money goes to both the county and other parties.
We do them every 30 days out to the taxing bodies, which meaning your schools, your cities, your townships.
Normally after mailing out bills, the county would start collecting these taxes in June, but Beck says they were deferred because of COVID-19.
If it was normal schedule, it would have been in probably June 5th or June 12th. So we set the first installment as July 1st and our second installment as September 11th.
Even with the delay, Ogle County has already collected about 55% of its property taxes. Beck says this matches up with how much they collected last year. She notes that other counties have used different ways to ease the burden on taxpayers.
I think some counties, other counties have waived that first installment penalty for 30 days or 60 days, but I don't see where, with what we have collected, where it's been a real struggle with Ogle County.
Beck says what's more uncertain at her level are the county's share of tax revenue that comes from the state.
I'm just curious about now, within the next month or so, what the income tax will be, other sales tax, if they're going to drop drastically. It's now just kind of starting to hit us too.
This also affects municipal governments. Rochelle City Manager Jeff Fagenshoe says it's hard to tell what effect COVID-19 has had on some taxes. This is because taxes collected by the state are remitted to local governments 2 months later.
Our April sales tax was off $10,000 from last year. So far, our revenues have not taken a big hit, but we've only seen 1 month of actual revenue collected when the pandemic started.
To address less money coming into households and businesses, he says the city took several different measures. These include waiving late fees for their local electrical utility and changing the eligibility requirements for a low-income assistance program for that utility.
The maximum you were able to get last year was $300, and it was based on you had to be at 150% of the poverty level. The city council increased that to a maximum of $500, and they increased the income limit to 200%, so we could try to get more people assistance.
Other examples include the city council setting aside $200,000 for a grant program aimed at so-called non-essential businesses.
They were $5,000 grants, and the businesses could use those grants for utilities or back rent or taxes or anything that, you know, all those expenses that continue to accrue even if you're not open.
Fagenshoe says Rochelle was also fortunate in another way.
A lot of our large sales tax generators in Rochelle were deemed essential, like the hardware stores and Walmart and our car dealerships. So, you know, we didn't have like a mall or anything like that that was forced to shut down, where, you know, which in normal times would generate, you know, huge sums of sales tax revenue.
But that doesn't mean any of these parties are out of the woods when it comes to finance. Tricia Herrera is the executive director of the Rochelle Chamber of Commerce.
You know, we don't have a time frame on when this is all going to be over. So they're trying to do things in long range planning. You know, how do I sustain this? And how do I be able to pay my bills long range? not just even in the immediate.
For county and local governments, that means juggling how to balance their budgets while maintaining services. For businesses, it means keeping up with regular expenses. Herrera says some measures have helped.
You know, you can't suspend all of those type of things, but you can do what you can. The city of Rochelle has to ease the burden on business owners.
But the long-term trajectory of revenue, what aid will come in from the state, and how the pandemic will change these two factors all remain uncertain. I'm Chase Cavanaugh.
This is Statewide. There's more on the way. An Illinois man has the story of his family's tragedy. That's just ahead. And we are back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, the use of an invasive species to solve another problem, food insecurity. That story is still ahead. A Springfield man is mourning after a massive explosion at a port warehouse in Beirut, Lebanon, injured thousands and killed about 200 people, including his mother. Maureen McKinney talked recently with Nabi El-Haj. He's from the Springfield area and is director of an education nonprofit. His mother, Zaina, died of her injuries the day following the early August blast.
Can you tell me about the day the explosion happened?
Yeah, It was a nice day here in Springfield. I like to bike on the Sangamon Valley Trail, and so I was getting ready to go on a bike ride, and I usually call my mom in the morning before I head out and do anything. So I called my mom, and she didn't pick up, and I didn't make much of it. I thought it was the same time that she would be getting home from work, so I thought she was busy doing something else. And a few minutes later, my brother called and said we heard he was at work and said we heard this explosion, but there's nothing on the news and we can't tell where it happened. Did you hear anything, you know, there? Is there anything showing up on your news? And I said, no, there's nothing, but I called my mom and she didn't pick up, and so I don't know. And so we thought, okay, let's call my sister, Nadine, see where she's at. And so we called her and she didn't pick up. And so then my brother started getting really worried, so he left work. And he started heading back towards our home. And meanwhile, I have him on the line, but I'm constantly dialing my sister to see if she'll pick up. And eventually she did. And from her voice, we could tell that she was scared. She kept saying, what happened? What happened? And I said, well, what do you mean? You know, and she said, well, the walls have caved here. I'm at the gym. I'm at the school. I don't know what happened. There's a lot of smoke. And so the background, for me and my siblings, we were born during the Civil War. We lived through many conflicts. We've seen bombings. We've seen certain destructions. We lived through the assassination of the prime minister, which happened two blocks down the road from our school. So we've lived through destruction in the past. And to hear how scared and how worried she was had us realize that this wasn't another one of those bombings. It wasn't another incident. It was something severely wrong had happened. So she started making her way. She successfully made her way out of the school and then started making her way. And it was down the road from our home. So she started making her way home. Usually that's a 10-minute walk from to our home, but it took her 30 or 40 minutes to get there, where, you know, the rubbles were everywhere. It was destruction. The smoke was so thick she barely see or breathe, and trying to make her way through to get to mom, because mom was still not picking up. We're constantly calling her and calling her. We tried calling the neighbors and no one would pick up either. We you know, we called the priest and he wouldn't pick up either. We called everyone who we could think about calling while my brother and sister trying to make their way there. As my brother was getting closer to the neighborhood, the roads were closed, and there was no way he could drive in, so he abandoned his car on the highway and he took running on foot to get our mom. We lived on the top floor in the building, and that was about a third of a mile from where the explosion happened. And so as they made their way up to the apartment, they found my mom, and she was injured. She had bled a lot. So they carried her and ran down to the street. They tried stopping They tried stopping an emergency vehicle, and they found a Red Cross van was pulling up, and they managed to put my mom in the back of the van, and they drove her to a hospital on the west side of Beirut. And so she went to brain surgery, and she had blood transfusion, but she didn't make it. She died the next morning.
Tell me about your mother.
She's a wonderful woman. She was petite, about 5'2", but, you know, very sharp. She would fill the room. She was very articulate, very sociable. She made friends with everyone. She was very kind. And we were very close to her. My siblings and I were very close to my mom. We were friends. We went to her with everything, especially after my dad died. And in 08, we were very young, and so she was the only parent we had left, so we even got closer to her. I came back here after my dad died to finish my education, and she raised my brother and sister by herself, so we kind of watched her, you know, work hard and struggle as a widow to make ends meet, to, you know, make sure that my brother gets through school, to make sure that my sister gets through school. And she was a very strong woman in our eyes. She worked all her life. She worked in accounting. She was a few years away from retirement. And so we got our strength from her. Every time we dreamt about something, we would dream big because, you know, she wanted us to, because, you know, she was that example for us. And, you know, having lost her is leaving a big hole in our hearts and in our lives.
Were you able to attend the funeral?
It happened the following day after she died. So it was very quick. And, you know, given COVID, given everything that's happening in Lebanon, I wasn't able to attend. My mom is in a better place. The funeral, I just wanted to be there for my siblings as they mourn. I lost my mom, and it's a pretty shocking to me, and still I'm somewhat in disbelief, but I didn't see her. I wasn't there for the explosion. I didn't have to dig my way through rubble. I feel for my siblings. I think their experience is much more traumatic than mine. I'm grieving, but I think their grief is much deeper than mine and much scarier than mine. And this is why I wanted to be there, but I just couldn't.
And what's next for your family?
The next step for us and my family is, you know, I live here with my wife, and we're the only family left for my siblings. And so for us at this point, all of our effort is to try to reunite with them, so we can help them restart their lives, so we can keep them safe, so they can worry about normal things like, you know, finding jobs and buying a home, and not have to worry about, you know, whether or not they're safe if they're sleeping at home, or whether or not they have a home, or whether or not they can eat the next day. So that's all of our energy is being put towards that goal now.
That's Nabil Hajj. His mother died in the recent explosion in Beirut, and he spoke with Maureen McKinney. Bronze bust Carl Sandburg commissioned of himself has found a new home. It will be displayed in Galesburg at the community college named after the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer. Rich Egger reports.
The family of the late artist Fingal Rosenquist donated the bust to the college. Rosenquist met Sandburg around 1940, and in the late 1950s, Sandburg spent about a week at her studio to sit for the sculpture. Lisa Walker believes the fact that Sandburg commissioned the bust makes it a meaningful work.
There are a lot of pieces of art done of famous people. That's just the nature of the beast. But to know that he sat for this one gives it, at least for us here at the college, a more personal touch.
Walker coordinates the art program at Carl Sandburg College. She says the piece is about 3 feet high and 3.5 or 4 feet wide and weighs at least 350 pounds. She says the bust has him sitting as though his arms are on a table. Walker says looking at it, You would not know it portrays such a well-known and beloved writer.
It was his choice to be portrayed just as an ordinary person. And I kind of like that, you know. He always talked about being, you know, a man of the people and, you know, to show himself in this sculpture that he himself commissioned as a just a guy. You know, I think that's actually really sweet.
The bust was meant for a school in New Jersey, but ended up back with Sandberg, who gave it to Rosenquist. She died in 1980. The bust remained in her family, though they recently decided the piece should get a new home. Walker says the college needs to create a pedestal for the bust before it can be displayed. The school also must decide where it will be displayed, and because it's bronze, it could be placed either indoors or outdoors. Rich Egger reporting.
Renters have more time to apply for assistance through the state of Illinois. An application deadline had been set for this past week. Now renters have until August 28th. The extension is due to the recent storms in northern Illinois. The program allows for up to $5,000 for those who have faced financial hardship due to COVID-19. Landlords must provide additional documentation. More details, as well as assistance in completing the forms, can be found at the Illinois Housing Development Authority website. Estimates show approximately 500,000 households in Illinois missed a rent payment in the past month. While the applications are for renters, officials say the extension won't delay the launch of a similar program, which will help pay mortgages. Food insecurity and invasive Asian carp are two long-standing issues. And as Tim Shelley reports from Peoria, a group believes it has discovered a path to use one problem to solve another.
The idea of serving Asian carp from the Illinois River at the dinner table isn't a new one, but previous efforts to convince people to chow down on the fish have floundered. A group of community stakeholders sees an opportunity to connect the new Midwest Fishing Co-op that targets the invasive fish with groups combating food insecurity. East Peoria businessman Roy Source has a facility on the Illinois River banks, which is a component of the new co-op supply chain.
We feel this has a lot of applications. It's a very good product and can be easily harvested and deliverable to those different entities.
Source recently received approval to freeze harvested fish for shipment to processing facilities. The minced, still frozen fish then come back to his business for storage and sale. This process extends the shelf life of the fish. People like Midwest Food Bank Peoria Division Head Monica Shire say that's good news.
Fish is usually not something at all that they can get at all, just because of shelf life. It's just not within the emergency food system at all. So this is a great way to get a variety of protein sources.
Getting the raw product is only the first step. How does one actually eat Asian carp and enjoy it? One cook says it's surprisingly easy.
It's very versatile. It's a mild tasting fish.
That's Clint Carter. He's the president of the Midwest Fishing Co-op and co-owner of Carter's Fish Market in Springfield.
Whatever you want to taste like, you just mix whatever seasoning you want.
Carter says working with Asian carp isn't dissimilar to cooking with ground beef or turkey. On a recent July day, he cooked Asian carp taco meat, teriyaki, and soy fish for the stakeholder group to sample. Dr. Leslie McKnight directs community health policy and planning for the Peoria City County Health Department. McKnight says she was surprised by the pleasant taste of Asian carp taco meat.
I just need the tortilla, some lettuce and tomato, and a little sour cream. I think I'm good. And some cheese. So it tastes pretty good.
McKnight is one of the players developing a food equity hub as a grocery store alternative for the food desert on the south side of Peoria. And she sees opportunity with this Asian carp initiative.
If we can harvest the Asian carp and we can learn how to cook it, this can definitely be another alternative of a healthy food product for our community.
The Food Equity Hub will offer cooking classes and other services when it opens. The Midwest Food Bank already offers cooking classes. Monica Shire, the Midwest Food Bank director in Peoria, says she's eager to explore the possibilities of this out-of-the-box thinking on Asian carp.
It tends to be a nuisance here in the Peoria area or in central Illinois, and to be able to utilize it and really to reach out to us in the emergency food system to make a real impact. It's really brilliant. It's great.
If it works, there will be plenty of fish to go around. I'm Tim Shelley.
In addition to food banks, Roy Source says there may also be opportunities for the industry to eventually serve Asian carp at soup kitchens, prisons, and for the military. That's all the time we have for Statewide. We'll be back again next week with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. Remember, you can find all of our episodes, including this one, at statewideshow.com. Want to know where to hear our show? You can find a rundown of the stations and times when Statewide airs across Illinois, again at our website. Our weekly podcast is available through the NPR One app. Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.